Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
This was a triumph. I'm making a note here, huge success. It's hard to overstate my satisfaction. Aperture Science. We do what we must because we can. For the good of all of us, except the ones who are dead.
You realize what that means? The millions of complex electronic functions. The memory chips, the muscle activators, the photo-optical cells. To say nothing of a storage bank containing every scrap of information known about mankind. Nothing but a machine, indeed. That piece of tin and wire is a machine, but you are not human.
All these points of data make a beautiful line, and we're out of data, we're releasing on time. Time that I got done, think of all the things we learned for the people who are still alive.
We are more alike than unlike, my dear Captain. I have pores. Humans have pores. I have fingerprints. Humans have fingerprints. My chemical nutrients are like your blood. If you prick me, do I not leak?
Look at me still talking when there's science to do. When I look up there, it makes me glad I'm not you. I've experimented on, there is research to be done on the people who are still alive.
You're a machine, Alan, a mechanical device. I don't believe it.
I don't blame you. I wouldn't believe it either. But it's true. The fact is, you were born a long time ago inside my head. All kids have dreams, don't they? You were mine. The others thought about joining the army or flying to Mars, and they finally grew up and they forgot their dreams. I didn't. I thought about one thing and longed for one thing always. Just one. A perfect artificial man.
Open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. Next will be Talking Twilight Zone.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone. It's so great to have you here on this beautiful afternoon. This is the beginning of summer.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Happy summer, everybody.
Yes, happy summer. It's the beginning of summer. Yesterday, I think, was the first day of summer, wasn't it?
Yeah. Longest day.
Yeah. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yesterday was the longest day of the year, first day of summer, and it was a gorgeous day, and I'm loving it. I'm loving it more than I love the rain that we had the past couple of weeks. Unfortunately, that was a carryover from those horrible tornadoes that they had in Oklahoma, devastated parts of Oklahoma, and very sad about that. And our hearts go out to those people. But on another note, I just wanted to say how sad I am to hear of James Gandolfini's death over the weekend. I believe it was Thursday night, wasn't it? Robert, do you remember? Bobby? Robert, anybody remember? It was Thursday night, wasn't it? Yes, it was Thursday night, right?
Thursday, yeah.
Thursday night. Yeah, poor man.
Mr. Soprano himself, unfortunately.
Mr. Yep. Tony Soprano. You thought nothing could bring that man down. That guy was supposed to live forever, right? Poor man vacationing in Italy and struck down by a heart attack. Feel bad. We'll miss you, Tony. Thanks for the memories. Guy was pretty awesome. And what a light.
I wanted to thank you guys. It was great seeing you last week and
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah, and we got to meet Robert and his lovely wife, Julianne, last weekend, and that was pretty wonderful.
Why don't you come over to the show tonight?
Oh, Final yeah, one. I'll drive about 500 miles over there to say hello to you. Hello.
<right.
laughs> I wanted to thank you for our present that you gave us, the TARDIS cookie jar, because I'm very much looking forward, because we got a world market here where they sell Jimmy Dodgers. And the nice thing about the TARDIS cookie jar, and Dave could probably attest to this, it's big on the inside. Thank you.
Not as big as your stomach, I bet, now.
I'm sorry I ate all the cookies before we gave it to you.
I know.
Well, I'm glad you liked it. And thank you for the mug and for the chocolates and yummy, which of course we've been enjoying. And
good.
Sebastian loved having you here too. In case anyone does not know, Bobby and I have a son now. His name is Sebastian, and he is now, yes, he's adorable. He is now, I guess he's now 12 weeks old, just about 12 weeks old. Our little
play with paper bags and everything.
Yes, our little gray and white tabby kitten, Sebastian, and he's a sweetheart. And, most of the time, when he's not being a terror, he's a sweetheart. He's trying to tear up our shower curtain and everything else he can get his little claws on. But other than that, he really is a sweetheart when he's sleeping. But he's adorable and loves to play, and we're real happy to have him with us now. So anyway, after dispensing with all of the good and bad news, or bad and good news, whatever, we are now up to season 4 of the Twilight Zone. Oh, season 4. Yes.
I missed season 3 already.
Oh,
it's
my God.
A few weeks.
The 1-hour episodes. Luckily, it's a short season. And while they're not all bad, there are a handful that are fairly decent. A lot of them leave much to be desired. And today's opening season 4 episode, that's kind of up and down. It's not terrible. It's not great. But with season 4 and the hour-long episodes, we have to expect some good and bad, mostly bad. So anyway, this one is going to be In His Image, is what it's called. In His Image, starring George Grizzard. And I'm going to give it to Robert for the opening clip. And before I do that, I'd like to welcome guest number 5. Thank you, guest 5, for being here. And now with that, Robert, please, opening clip.
What you have just witnessed could be the end of a particularly terrifying nightmare. It isn't. It's the beginning. Although Alan Talbot doesn't know it, he's about to enter a strange new world. Too incredible to be real, too real to be a dream. It's called The Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here we are. That was a short narration. Now here we are in season 4. Well, you know, I have to say, Charles Beaumont stories, they've always been kind of up and down for me. Then again, so I have Rod Serling's and Richard Matheson's and George Clayton Johnson's and so on. I mean, none of the Twilight Zone writers are without their duds. I mean, that goes without saying. And Charles Beaumont, I love some of his stuff, and some of his stuff is like thumbs down. For me, some of Beaumont's duds have been Elegy, The Fugitive, and the most regrettable Once Upon a Time. And some of his winners for me are The Howling Man, Long Distance Call, Living Doll, of course, and Printer's Devil. Well, the way I see In His Image falls somewhere in between the duds and the winners. It leans more toward the duds, but it's not terrible. Beaumont based this episode on his own short story titled The Man Who Made Himself. And that story was published in the 1957 issue of Imagination Magazine. I've never actually had an issue of that magazine. I've always meant to look it up on eBay to see if I can get an old back issue. I've always wanted to read one of those Imagination magazines. I don't know if anyone here has ever seen that or read it. Anybody? No? No, no imagination. Yeah, imagination.
No imagination. Imagination.
No imagination, you people. I don't know. I'm going to look it up on eBay. If I can find a copy, I'd like to buy one just to see. It supposedly was a decent magazine. I don't know. But I do have to say that George Grizzard, he gave a much better performance in this episode than he did in season one's utterly ridiculous The Chaser. Ugh, horrible, horrible episode. But in this story, he played the roles of creator, Walter Ryder, and creation, Alan Talbot. He played them perfectly. I mean, he had to portray two completely different personalities, and I thought he did so quite impressively. It's kind of tough, you know, in 1 hour having to portray these two different people. And in a way, the story actually reminded me of season two's Nervous Man in the $4 Room, in which Joe Mantel played a man who was, he was dealing with his identical alter ego through a mirror. But I thought the effects weren't nearly as good in Nervous Man as they were in this one. And if there were split-screen scenes during In His Image, I didn't think they could be detected at all, because there were scenes where George Grizzard and, you know, the two George Grizzards were nose-to-nose, and I didn't see any theme down there, but unless I missed it.
Can I ask you then, did it also remind you of that actor played the one with the shoes, you know, that he put the criminal's shoes on?
His
persona changed, and the same actor did that, you know, went from a sort of a weak-willed, mild-mannered to, you know, a bit of a wife batterer, really.
And I believe that very well. Barry Nelson, wasn't it? Barry Nelson?
But the point is, it was a similar sort of acting challenge to do that as this.
Yeah, because you're playing a character who in a split second has to change from one personality to another. So he was playing this mild-mannered guy, and then all of a sudden he has to change over into a thug, you know, a killer. And he did that within split seconds. Yeah, I thought you're right, Dave, because I thought he did that quite well. And Barry Nelson played that role. So that's a pretty tough role, too. That is a pretty tough role. I mean, to have to change, you know, within one episode, to have to keep changing, you know, different personalities. And Joe Mantel did that in Nervous Man. Even though I didn't really care for that episode, Nervous Man in a $4 Room, Joe Mantel did do that quite well, where he played, you know, the scared, you know, guy who didn't want to kill anybody, and then you got the guy in the mirror who's playing the, you know, his alter ego, saying, "Yes, you can. You know, you got to grow some. You know, you got to grow a couple, and you know, start being a man." So yeah, I think that's a good comparison. Well, you know, this plot line really was nothing new. I mean, it's been seen in other episodes. I mean, it's the old I know where I am and who I am, but nobody knows me. That kind of thing. Except we had to put up with it for an hour this time. I mean, yeah, the hour long episodes, you know, for better or worse, we have to deal with them. But what I didn't get in this situation was the deal with the girlfriend, Jessica. Now, it's mentioned at the beginning that they've only known each other for 4 days. And they're getting married. They're getting married. I mean, he even tells her that maybe she should know a little more about him. Now, he's an android. And he tells her that she should know a little more about him. He's showing more common sense than she is. I mean, he's an android, and he's showing common sense. And she's saying, "Oh, no, I know all I want to know about you." Oh, really? You know, 4 days. And he's
a former woodchucker, and he would chuck wood, you know.
I think it's playing on the paranoia of the time in the early 60s that if a woman was approaching her 30th birthday and not married, she'd sort of grab anything warm. You know, she'd grab anything
right.
Wearing
trousers.
Well,
what about
trousers,
young man Fancy? Come on, what about that gal there?
That's
how long
right.
She wait on him?
12 years. Yeah, and then, boy, wasn't she sorry. It's either you wait too long or you don't wait long enough. I don't know. But, my God, I mean, 4 days and she's ready to marry this guy. And he's an android saying, well, maybe we should get to know each other better. The android's got the common sense and she doesn't. But she disagrees, you know, and she says, oh, I want to marry you. So that, but then he takes her to what's supposed to be his hometown. And nobody knows him, and nothing's the way that it's supposed to be. Nothing's what he remembers. So you think that, you know, she'd be a little bit wary of him at that point. Mm. Of course, you do also see after that, he has this major fit in the woods, and he screams at her to drive off and leave him. So you would think that most women at that point would hightail it out of town. I mean, this guy's got a little screw loose, but not Jessica. Good old Jessica, yeah, she's all right. She decides to stick it out. That's pretty brave, considering she's only known this nut for 4 days, you know. You know, Jessica's a good woman, you know. She's, I'll stick it out with you no matter what, even if you're ready to kill me. You know, but my other issue with this episode, remember when he goes up to Aunt Mildred's house, and the man, what he thought was his Aunt Mildred's house, and the man opens the door and tells him that's not his Aunt Mildred's house? Well, okay, fine. You know, he goes up to the house. He realizes, you know, mistakenly that it was, he thought it was his Aunt Mildred's, but it wasn't. So he leaves and he's dazed and confused. But I didn't see any reason why the guy had to call the cops. The guy calls the cops. And then all of a sudden, the cops and the guy manage to find him and Jessica in the cemetery. Now, you got to tell me how they knew to go to the cemetery to find them. I mean, come on. Would they drive all over town until they found them at the cemetery? I mean, that seems a little bit silly, don't you think? I mean, come on.
Okay, young man, you just stay off my yard now. You hear me?
Get off of my property! And Alan,
he just wanted more screen time. That's all.
Well, I mean, you know, Alan and Jess, they didn't exactly seem very threatening. I mean, I thought that whole scene was totally unnecessary. And there you go with the filler. There's why you have your scenes that have to fill in that hour, and that was one of them. It's like you actually have to show the scene where the man is calling the cops and drive to the cemetery to find that. So there's your filler part. And the ending, that was also a puzzle to me. I mean, Walter does away with Alan the android. Okay, he's the creator. He does away with his creation. And then he steps into his place as Jessica's new fiancé. So tell me, we're supposed to believe that Jessica isn't going to catch on to the fact that Walter isn't the same guy, the android, that she fell in love with 4 days ago? I mean, well, maybe not. I mean, maybe she won't. If she's desperate enough to marry a man after only 4 days, I suppose she's not going to be very picky. But still, are we supposed to believe that Walter's ready to marry this woman that he doesn't even know? Now, he's not an android. He's a man, a human man. So he's ready to marry this woman. He doesn't even know her. He doesn't know crap about her.
Yeah, good luck explaining that scar on your chest there.
Yeah,
buddy.
Exactly. I mean, this self-proclaimed genius, he seems to be suffering from a lack of self-esteem and shyness, so I guess he's open to a relationship with just about any woman, especially one who's already in love with him. So that does eliminate some of the groundwork for him, I guess, but I just thought that was ridiculous. But this episode wasn't as bad as a lot of the other season 4 offerings. It has its issues, but I don't have a problem with George Grizzard. I didn't care for the Chaser, but that's not his fault. He appeared in a lot of TV series in the 50s and 60s, and he was also a very accomplished theater performer, which I don't think a lot of people knew. And actually, I didn't know that until I did a little research on him. And in fact, he won a Tony Award in 1996 for his work in a play called A Delicate Balance. So, you know, I thought he did a good job in this episode. He died in 2007, unfortunately, at the age of 79. Now, Gail Coby, she was Jessica, and she was in 3 Twilight Zone episodes, and she's still around. She's 81, but she hasn't acted since 1975. She became a soap opera producer, did that throughout the 80s. And Kathleen Squire was the religious zealot in the subway, and she was, I liked her in that. I thought she was really cool as that religious, you know, zealot there in the subway that gets unfortunately knocked into the subway in front of the subway car. But she was, we saw her as Paul Reagan's ex-teacher in season 3's One More Paul Barron. So, in my opinion, season 4, that's an excruciating season for the zone, but It's got a handful of decent to good episodes. Some are downright unbearable. This one wasn't unbearable, but it sure doesn't win any prizes. Acting and effects were good. I wasn't crazy about the light that came over Alan's face every time he was about to have a fit. Remember Purple Testament?
Testament, yeah, I think.
Once again, they're stealing ideas from past episodes. But I do give credit to whoever did the split screen thing, because that was well done. You didn't notice that. I'm giving it a 2 for average. Nothing terrific, but I'm not going to say it was horrible. So, over to you, Robert.
Thank you, Lynn. Yeah, I pretty much feel that this episode, it's something we talked about in the past about how a lot of these 22-minute, 25-minute episodes could have really used a little more fleshing out, you know. And, you know, here was an opportunity. You got 18 stories in this season. One that normally you could have showed for 25 minutes and maybe needed more fleshing out would have fit nicely in this hour segment of the season. But unfortunately, this was not one. And this was basically, you know, a 50-minute episode that should have been told in 25 minutes. Really didn't need the hour format for this episode. And, you know, you mentioned the fillers, the part, you know, the graveyard scene, and even the subway scene was a little too drawn out.
Wasn't
for me
that long? That was very long, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that was just basically to fill in for, as you said, time as well. But, of course, here we have the two sides of the coin, you know, the one side, the introduction of the characters, and the search for one's identity, yawn. The other side is the confrontation and the realization that he's not a real human being, but an emo android with a Jackal and Hyde complex is basically what it is. And, you know, if Alan didn't push that old woman in the subway, I would have. I was getting kind of tired of that.
I thought she did a good job. I really did. I thought she did a great job as being the annoying.
Save your soul! Save your soul!
I mean, you know.
God love you!
That's right. That's how those religious freaks are, if you've ever seen them, like, you know, in subways and airports and all. I mean, they're ready to attack you with their Bible, you know. But I thought she did a good job at that. But I agree. If somebody came at me like that, I'd be ready to push her in the subway, too. Like,
please, lady, leave me alone and put your pampa in the toilet.
That's right. And
maybe
and
I'll
said,
pick it up on the way out.
And he said that to her. How many times did he say, leave me alone, leave me alone? So, you know, you can't blame the guy for getting, I mean, he killed her, okay, he killed her, but, you know, you just get to a point where you want to push them away or do something.
And why didn't the train stop? I mean, someone didn't see her go under the train. Usually don't the subway train stops or someone pulls the cord.
They can't stop in that distance.
Really?
It takes about 100 yards to stop.
Wow.
Yeah, you can't know. A subway car cannot stop that fast. I mean, you need a lot of time to stop a subway train. Well, even a regular train, you know, like in Hitchhiker, you know, even if she hadn't gotten out of the car, I mean, that guy was, that's why they ring those, toot those horns or whatever. It's like, get out of the way, because I can't stop that fast, you know?
Yeah,
if it could stop that fast, he'd kill three of them aboard, because they'd get squashed against the front of the, I mean,
that's right.
inside of the thing.
Everybody go flying. Everybody be flying out the window. Oh, man.
But, yeah, really, that was very much drawn out. But, you know, watching this, I was thinking, and also, you know, it's another version of Frankenstein with the monster finding his way back to his creator, and very much predated story. It reminded me of from Star Trek Next Generation, an episode called Brothers. Season 4, Episode 3, where they're spoiler
remember
warning.
Remember that
the,
episode?
Yeah, Data is called back to a planet where his creator, Nguyen Song, was there, and he was pretty much wanting to give him a gift. And I was remembering the scene from In His Image, and then the scene from the Brothers one. So let me
go
ahead.
That far, sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, you're going back, mentioning the woman in the Bible. We're actually going back to Cain and Abel, really, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. The two brothers.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But like I said, it's a story that's been told for ages. And let me go ahead and I'll play a little bit of the scene from In His Image and then the one from the Star Trek Next Generation one.
Okay.
Thing and long for one thing, always. Just one. A perfect artificial man. Not a robot. A duplicate of a human being. Well, it was harmless. Not even very imaginative for a child. But then I became an adult. Only somewhere along the line I forgot to grow up, like most geniuses. I kept my dream. I created you, Alan. Is that straight enough for you? You're not only drunk, you're crazy. How would you explain that? What, it's an artificial arm. I don't know. You expect me to believe I'm a machine when I know I'm not? That's ridiculous. I eat, I drink, I sleep. Didn't I tell you I wanted a perfect creation? Alan? Alan, I want you to come with me.
Where?
Well, let's call it the delivery room.
May I ask you a question, sir?
Certainly. Anything you like.
Why did you create me?
Why does a painter paint? Why does a boxer box? You know what Michelangelo used to say? That the sculptures he made were already there before he started, hidden in the marble. All he needed to do was remove the unneeded bits. Wasn't quite that easy with you, Data. But the need to do it, my need to do it, was no different than Michelangelo's need. Now let me ask you a question. Why are humans so fascinated by old things? Old things. Old buildings, churches, walls, ancient things, antique things, tables, clocks, knickknacks. Why?
There are many possible explanations.
If you brought a Newfian to Earth, he'd probably look around and say, tear that old village down, it's hanging in rags. Build me something new, something efficient. But to a human, that old house, that ancient wall, it's a shrine. Something to be cherished. Again, I ask you, why?
Perhaps for humans, old things represent a tie to the past.
Well, what's so important about the past? People got sick. They needed money. Why tie yourself to that?
Humans are mortal. They seem to need a sense of continuity.
Aha. Why?
To give their lives meaning, a sense of purpose.
Oh. And, this continuity, does it only run one way? Backwards? To the past?
I suppose it is a factor in the human desire to procreate.
Oh. So you believe that having children gives humans a sense of immortality, do you?
It is a reasonable explanation to your query, sir.
And to yours as well, Data.
Like we have ourselves a family reunion.
It just shows the comparison between the two scenes from In His Image and the episode Brothers. So, I mean, we get these stories about, you know, machines and mechanical men. One very popular one, if we remember, is the Terminator movies and series, and out of the favorite of the Terminator movies, Terminator 2 was my favorite. And a lot of action, have Arnold in it, and we also get introduced to the liquid Terminator in that one. And there's a trailer for this.
Same make.
These were taken at the West Highland Police Station, 1984. You were there.
Same model.
These were taken today.
You have to let me see my son. He's in great danger.
New mission. Once, he was programmed to destroy the future.
I don't know what it's like to try to kill one of these things.
Now, his mission...
Get down!
...is to protect it.
Come with me if you want to live.
And that's kind of the extreme with the Terminator, Skynet and all that come about. So, like I said, I mean, he's, you know, iRobot, and there's others that pretty much take the premise of the android situation and to go from the android to cyborg situation, which I think that was what Alan was saying about, you know, take a look at your arm. And he was saying, you know, it was a robotic arm. He was thinking more along the lines that he was probably a cyborg.
Right.
More than
right.
an actual android total. So it would have been nice if, you know, he could have opened his stomach up or there was an access port to show, you know, he was the whole android, so to say. So
almost reminds you a little of The Lonely, you know, when they shot her in the face, Alicia mm-hmm. in the face, and you saw all of her workings inside of her face.
Yeah.
And that's the first time that I think Corey, the guy who was in love with her, realized, you know, that, I mean, he, I think he knew, well, he always knew she was a robot. That's the first time it really hit him, when he saw that, because he was really believing she was starting to be a woman.
Mm-hmm. Jean March did a great job in that role. I liked it.
She was fabulous in that.
Mm-hmm. So, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, hi, Sonny, and hi, Lou.
Hi, Sonny. Now, I'm just going to have finish up here, so I pass it over to Bobby there. I give it a 1 out of 5. Julie watched it with me last night, and she gave the same rating to a 1 out of 5. So.
Out of 5? Okay.
Mm-hmm. So we'll pass it on to the man, the legend.
Yeah.
Season 4, here we go with Bobby. Woohoo! Take it away, Bobby.
Well, I'm not going to waste my time discussing this incredible piece of crap. Too much has
okay,
been said.
Okay, too much for that.
Too much has been said about it already. Except to say that the most ridiculous scene of all is at the beginning of the story on the subway platform, because I don't care where you are or what city you're in, even at 4:30 in the morning, even if you were in a backwoods jerkwater town like Columbus, Ohio, you would certainly find somebody else on the subway platform. It is ridiculous to think that there's nobody anywhere, just him and that old lady, and that is absurd. I mean, I don't, if you're in New York or Philadelphia or anywhere, the pickpockets and the muggers alone would be somebody walking around. So it looks ridiculous. But, of course, it is convenient because there's nobody to see him throw her off the platform. But it just looks idiotic, and it just, you know, it's not important to the story. I mean, that there's nobody there, but it's an indication of how much CBS trashed the series. They couldn't even give Serling any money to hire a couple of extras to walk around. Are you serious? Are you kidding me? They don't even deserve to have that series. But like I said, I had the agony of having to watch that earlier this afternoon, and it's absolutely dreadful. And but it is a very important episode. It now that the first three seasons are over and the glory days are all gone, and they are, it's an important episode because everything that's wrong with the Twilight Zone as an hour is apparent in this story. Absolutely everything. It's agonizingly slow. And I watched it, and I watched the clock, too, not only because I wanted it to be over, but because you can look at it and see that all the parts of it, the beginning in which nobody recognizes him, could have been done in, let's take a half an hour. You got about 25, 26 minutes. let's say 26 after commercials. So you got 13 minutes in the first half and 13 minutes in the second half. And all of what happened there in the first half an hour could have been done in 13 minutes. Nobody, he doesn't recognize anybody. They don't recognize him. So obviously there's something wrong. You could easily do that in 12, 13 minutes at the beginning
of
the story.
Bobby,
yes.
Bobby,
yeah.
Didn't they already do that in Person or Persons Unknown? That was a half-hour episode, and it took
yeah.
a half hour, and you realized nobody recognized him. Joe, you're right. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And so you could easily do it that way. And then maybe the worst part of the entire episode is when he meets himself, the robot or whatever, meets the real man. I mean, he's talking to himself, and I'm sitting here, and I'm wondering, is this ever going to end? Is this just going to go on forever? It's hard to believe that it's, you know, it's about 20 minutes. It seems like about 3 hours. It just goes on and on and on and on. And that's what's the problem. And I hate to tell people, but I'm going to whine about this all the way through this season, because it is a disgrace.
Open
it's horrible.
Bottle,
I know
Dave.
There are some episodes that aren't bad. There's some that I like, but even in the ones I like, they're just too long. What this, like I said, this is a very valuable episode. You can see this alone and see what you're headed for. And it does answer the age old question, which is, can there be too much of a good thing? Yep, there sure can be. And this is a perfect example of it. I was a teenager when this series was on, pretty much. And I loved it, of course. And I probably was thrilled to death when it went to an hour. I probably thought to myself, well, you know, if it half an hour is great, an hour is going to be even fabulous. So, but it teaches you a lesson. Just because it gets longer doesn't mean it's any better. And this is a perfect example of that. And I just think that this particular story, which actually, although I wouldn't be crazy about it in any format, I think it might not have been a bad episode as a half an hour. It might not have been bad. But it's like Robert mentioned, it's very derivative. It's just Frankenstein reworked. So there's nothing new about it at all. Now, I did want to read something because I was at a website called FAQ Twilight, The Twilight Zone. Now, you may have read this stuff before, or I may have even posted a link to it at the group. I don't really remember. But there's a couple of comments in here about why the series went to an hour and what a disaster it was. And I'm just going to read a few of the paragraphs, and it's certainly not the whole thing. But the original producer of the series was Buck Houghton or Houghton. I don't know how he says his name.
Buck Houghton. Buck Houghton, yeah.
How do you pronounce it?
Houghton.
Really? Houghton. Is that right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so this is what it says. Buck Houghton was the producer of the first three seasons of The Twilight Zone. Houghton was the perfect balance to Serling and performed many of the behind-the-scenes tales that went into the series, including casting, actors, hiring directors, scoring, editing, and everything else that made the series work so well. Now, this comment is from me. People don't realize that. We like to talk about Serling. He was a genius. He was a brilliant writer. That goes without saying. But producers don't get enough credit. When you watch a TV series and you see the credits roll at the end, and there's an executive producer, you can't imagine how important that person is. He runs the whole show. I mean, the creator of the series doesn't run the whole show. Even the writers don't. The executive producer decides everything that's going to happen, what stories are going to do, and who's going to be in them, and it's very, very important. Then it says here, what involvement did CBS have? In the first season, involvement from the CBS executives seemed to allow things to run rather well, even though the series was under constant budget issues. But in between the first and second season, CBS was taken over by a somewhat bottom-line kind of guy, Jim Aubrey. Now, if you don't recognize that name, got to kind of be as old as I am in order to remember it. He was the president of CBS in the 60s.
Yeah.
And he decided he was going to make them the best network. And he did all right by putting a bunch of idiotic sitcoms on and canceling all of the dramatic shows. I mean, he was responsible for Gilligan's Island and Gomer Pyle, and he was responsible for Green Acres, Petticoat Junction, and the Beverly Hillbillies, and Mr. Ed. And that's not all of them. Remember this, CBS was a network that once had one of the most brilliant series in the history of television on it, Playhouse 90, in the mid-50s and into the late 50s. That was a brilliant show.
Rod Serling wrote for some of it.
I know, and that's what I'm saying. So that's the network that had that, and then Jim Aubrey comes in, this is what he does. Now it says here, apparently as the story goes, Aubrey was known for canceling several of CBS's prominent shows and replacing them with run-of-the-mill situation comedies. He was also known for constantly trying to cut the Twilight Zone's budget. Evidence of this is the fact that the second season is less 7 episodes than the first season. In the earlier seasons, episodes came close to production costs of $65,000 each. Boy, is that a joke. That's a pittance compared to today. And by having trimmed down the second season, Aubrey saved the network close to $500,000. So you see, you know, I mean, it's not about, it's all, always about money. That's why TV stings. But he was always at Sterling's throat, budget-wise, always wanting to cancel the series because it never reached top rating status. You know, The Twilight Zone never was in the top 30. Is that amazing? Never in the top 30. I mean, can you believe that? It's just hard to imagine. Huh?
Wasn't in the top,
no.
top 20 one year?
No, I'm afraid not. No, I checked all over the web earlier today, and everywhere I go it says no. It was never a rating success.
I thought maybe its second season it was. I guess not.
No, I'm not saying it didn't win its time period. It may have on certain years, but it was never, and, you know, that's all they care about is, you know, how works. So then the question is, why did Buck Houghton leave the show? At the end of the third season, The Twilight Zone had yet to secure a sponsor for an upcoming fourth season, and thusly was not included on CBS's fall schedule. At that point, Buck Houghton was offered a very good job with Four Star Productions and decided to accept the job as producer for The Richard Boone Show. How long did The Richard Boone Show last? One season. Then the question is, what did Sterling do after the third season? Well, in lieu of the sponsorless situation after the third season, when The Twilight Zone was basically put on hiatus, Sterling accepted an offer to teach at Antioch College in the fall of 62. Once The Twilight Zone was then picked up by CBS as a mid-season replacement in January 63, Sterling continued to teach, but his involvement during the fourth season would greatly diminish. Now, you can see where we're going here. This is why this is a disaster, because they canceled the show, and the most creative people behind it left. And who can blame them? If you have a job and somebody says you're sorry, but we're going out of business, and you say, all right, well, I got to find a new job. You go to a new job, and then he comes back to you and says, I decided not to go out of business. Well, he's out of luck, because you've got a new job now. What's the deal with the series coming back after a half-season hiatus? Due to a lack of sponsorship and the fact that The Twilight Zone was not scheduled for a fourth season, it was replaced with the hour-long situation comedy Fair Exchange. God, was that awful. This replacement didn't fare very well and was canceled mid-season, in which The Twilight Zone was brought back for a fourth season in January 63. Since it was starting mid-season and only had slots for 18 episodes, a choice was made to produce the fourth season at hour-length episodes. With Houghton elsewhere, the job of production went to experienced producer Herbert Hirschman. Then we get here, Hirschman's contract was up at the beginning of 63. And instead of re-signing with CBS to continue producing the series, he accepted another offer for a series filmed in England called Espionage. How long did that last? One season. Hirschman was then replaced by producer Bert Granite, who, interestingly enough, was the producer of The Time Element. Halfway through the fifth season, Granite was also offered a project he couldn't refuse, The Great Adventure, another flop. And since Sterling couldn't match the offer, Granite left.
I don't think it was ever the same after Houghton left.
I agree. That's why I'm reading this. The decision to change the fourth season to hour-long episodes, in fact, created stories that slowly drag along. They indeed failed to carry that same punch of the half-hour, two-act episodes.
Yeah.
The previous three seasons. With the impact of the series now starting to fade, CBS decided to bring the half-hour format back in the fifth season. And here's the last paragraph. This is one that's most interesting. Looking at the big picture, even by the beginning of the fifth season, Twilight Zone had already lost several of its most essential talents. Houghton was gone. Some of the directors were gone. At this point, Rod Serling was exhausted from writing for the series. He admitted he was burned out and knew he was not only repeating earlier stories, but he just couldn't tell bad from good anymore. That is amazing. And even though And even though the show's final fifth season features some of the most memorable episodes, it's clear that CBS president Jim Aubrey was tired of the show. And here's a shot. Listen to this. Actually, by the end of the second season, Aubrey had already admitted he was bored with it. And then it says in parentheses, some people clearly have little imagination. However, cancellation at that early stage would have been improbable. But by the end of the fifth season, even though the show's ratings were fairly good, they weren't high enough to justify renewing it for a sixth season, and the CBS fall schedule did not include The Twilight Zone. At the time, in the February issue of Daily Variety, Rod Serling was quoted as saying, "I decided to cancel the network." Well, that's really cute, but I'm afraid it was quite the other way around. So why is it an hour long? There's your answer right there. Because
they kept it going, too, for syndication purposes, is all pretty much ended up being.
Right.
But look at the most important people who left the show. You can't do that to a show. I mean, we talk about James Gandolfini. Look at The Sopranos. I mean, if everybody involved with the show had left after two or three seasons, it would have been garbage by the time it ended, because it just doesn't work that way. You got to think about it. What really gets to me, I understand that these people left because there appeared to be no job in their future, but they can't wait to get out of a series. I mean, if you're on a famous series, one that's doing at least fairly well and people think highly of it, and you're the producer, something comes along, they dangle something in front of you, and they go, "Listen, if you leave the Twilight Zone, you come here, you can run the whole show over here." Every one of those shows I named that the producers left bombed. One of them lasted half a season. I mean, that's a joke. You know, be happy with what you've got. Try to make it better. And don't always look for greener pastures somewhere else by trying to go to some other show. So that's the reason why it's an hour long. And frankly, even though, you know, Living Doll and Nightmare 20,000 Feet and a couple others are in the last season, I wish Serling had simply told CBS where to shove it and simply said, "You know what, you didn't want me before, and now I don't want you now." It would have been, show a little integrity in doing it that way. Sure, we would have lacked those stories, but who knows? You know, it's a shame. What's really a pity here is that it didn't do well enough in the ratings for some other network to pick it up. You see that all the time these days. Somebody, maybe NBC would have come along and said, "You know what, they don't want it, so we'll take it, that's fine." Instead, CBS, you got the president of the network who hates it, and he couldn't wait until it ended. Look, he's probably laughing his ass off at the end there because he saw the thing going down the toilet, and that's just fine. He couldn't wait to get rid of it. You know, all those other store things, Beverly Hills Police and Green Acres, I used to actually watch them, but they're not exactly...
Well, so did I, and some of them were hit shows. I mean,
oh, they were all hit shows. Are you kidding? He made millions for the network.
Yeah.
He had a great career.
Yeah, some of them were lousy comedies. But
he took them out of nowhere, and he gave them a schedule full of junk, and it sold. And listen, if you're president of the network, what's your job? Make money, and that's what he did.
Well, I think
Buck
Cotton was the worst part of
well,
the
Well, it shows in what happens after the third season. It's all over.
Because
and so
I got along well with Rod Serling.
I'm guilty of this, too. When you watch it, just remember, when you watch a series you really like, watch for the executive producer, because let me tell you something, he's the boss. And if it looks good, he's the reason why it looks good. I know the creator is important, too. It was Rod Serling's idea, but, you know, it's also really shocking for me to read in that last paragraph for Serling to say he couldn't tell bad from good anymore. I mean, what, did he lose his mind?
He said that. But Buck Houghton and Rod Serling got along very well, and I think that devastated Rod Serling when Buck left the show, because they were very close and they worked well together.
Well,
look at TV today. They go ahead and they get new blood in when a series gets tired, and sometimes that does help. Maybe what the Twilight Zone needed at that time, what were the best of writers, besides the two main ones we know of?
George Clayton
Johnson. That they could have gone after them, like Ray Bradbury
and other up-and-coming ones,
and bring them on. Yeah.
Not with the budget they gave him. Not with that budget.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is that when I was a kid, I loved to go to the library, and I loved reading, and I loved short stories, because I don't have the world's greatest attention span, so I was not one to read a whole book. And short stories were great. Some of them were really fabulous. And they were just real quick. You just read them, you got a lot out of it. But I didn't think to myself, you know what? Boy, if they would just add another 100 or 200 pages onto this, it would be a whole book. Just accept it for what it is. Those stories would be – I don't think this story, even though I don't like it, this image thing, might have been bearable as a half-hour story. Get rid of all that crap in the middle of it with the endless walking around, meeting everybody, and, God, the amount of time being wasted is absolutely astounding. So that's my complaint for the day. You're not going to hear the end of it because there's going to be other stories in which I'm going to say the same thing.
What's your rating on the episode?
Oh, I gave it a zero. I'm sorry. I get
you
nothing
sure you
out
gave it a zero? I don't remember giving it a zero.
No, I read the reviews in the file section. Yeah, I gave it a zero because you can't expect me to sit that long for something I don't like. It's just way too much. So now that we're here in the fourth season, It'll be agonizing, but we'll try to get through it somehow. All right, Lynn, that's it for
me. All right. Okay, and I also want to welcome, I did welcome Lou, and I want to welcome Bear Fan Ron. Yay, Bear Fan's here. Loyal listener, Zero, and he says Zero.
Yeah, but he missed everything I had to say, so the show's
over.
No,
he was here. No, he was here for you. He's had a lot to say about you. He said it was nice to see that you have no opinion about this. And he also said you gave it a zero. Holy Moses.
I don't hesitate to give zeros when it's deserved.
See, Bobby don't mind parting Red Sea once in a while, don't you, Bobby?
That's right.
No,
Ron usually tunes in just to hear you, Bobby. He loves hearing
you. I can understand that.
And now, Dave.
Well, I'm going to try and refute nearly everything that Bobby's just said, because...
All right, I'm hanging up. I'll see you all next show. Bye.
I think you're hanging too much on this episode. I mean, this episode is getting all the bile for the whole series, I think. So I think being harsh on this one episode. I mean, whether the one-hour format works over a season or a series or not, I'm sure that's a much more questionable point of view, and quite a strong argument can be made against it. But I think maybe I'm putting words into your mouth, but maybe you're taking a swipe at the whole series four in all that you've just said, rather than that zero rating just being on this one episode. But let me go through a few things. I wasn't going to start with it first, but Robert just mentioned something that I was going to mention, and that's this. I don't think necessarily a turnover of staff, certainly over after three seasons, is a bad thing. That's exactly what's kept Doctor Who on the UK TV screens, you know, and it's still going from the 1960s, and it's still going now, because every 3 years they have a general shift and a new team come in. Admittedly, if people are changing mid-season and people are dropping out like flies, then you've got no continuity and you get no structure and you get no direction and you get no leadership. And you're quite right, Bobby, you need that strong executive producer. But if you get people coming in for 3 years, and when they start, and this is happening in Doctor Who, some of the people that have left Doctor Who have said, I was starting to repeat my ideas, so I thought it was time to leave. And they've moved on to other things. Because it's been so successful, they've been able to move on to other more successful things. They haven't sort of suddenly been retired and forgotten about. They've gone on to do other drama and other works.
A good example is John Pertwee, when he left and Tom Baker came on, they changed the whole production, didn't they?
They've just done it a year or two ago with Russell T. Davis leaving and Stephen Moffat being the showrunner. Stephen Moffat may well be coming to his end now. Matt Smith, as the Doctor, is coming to the end. He's just announced he's going to be leaving at some point in the near future. So that renewal has been what's kept the programme fresh. Let me talk about this particular story. Now, I do think it was a little long, but I do get upset when people say, you know, an hour-long episode. No, it's not an hour-long episode. You've got so many blooming adverts in the US. This is about a 45-minute episode. I always thought that the trouble with a half-hour episode was that it was only about 22, 23 minutes of actual story.
23
yeah,
minutes.
And I think I'm not saying something that I haven't said before. I try and be consistent. I said before, in actual fact, the half-hour format is ideal for this show if it didn't have adverts, because it needed usually that extra 5 or 6 minutes breathing space. It might not need double the time. But again, we're not seeing an hour of drama here. We're seeing 40-odd minutes. And I suppose there is that financial imperative that leads that, because of course, although there's the less when you go from half an hour to an hour, you've got to pay the actors more. But on the other hand, if you're constructing a set like an underground or a hotel room or a milkshake bar, or what we call them, a bar, if you're using that set for twice as long, but you still only have to build the same set, So I suppose you're getting an hour's airtime with the adverts included for, you know, only 30-40% more cost, because the fixed costs of the actual stages and all that are the same. I don't think that should be what we're thinking about, but I can see that as being their point of view. Going back to right at the beginning, that woman was creepy on the underground. The copy I saw, and I only watched it recently, yesterday in fact, she seemed to have a funny eye, and then it wasn't a funny eye, and then it was a funny eye. But the point was that Bobby said that they couldn't afford to have anybody else around on the station, on the platform. But to me, that had to be like that, because if there had been witnesses, the whole story would have ground to a halt, because then he would have been pursued by police, this, that, and the other. And
that's what I thought too.
Yeah, he couldn't. The other thing is, it has a very important point. As we find out later, the inventor, the builder of the robot, says that the only way he could make a realistic replica of a person was to put a lot of himself in. So the point is, the trait that he can be capable of murder has been proved in that first scene. So although, as Lynn was saying, the robot in many sense was a very mild man, he was the one that told the girl should she reconsider this, that and the other and so on, and although he did start to flare up with the frustration of not recognising things and not being recognised built up. But the point is, that scene at the beginning where it shows that he is capable of murder, therefore his creator was capable of murder. We talk about the fact that they spent a long time with him, going around this town and doing it. Anybody remember a really great film called It's a Wonderful Life?
Uh-huh.
The bloke spent about half an hour in that, going around asking everybody in the blooming village, Joe, you remember me? Taxi, you drove me. Don't you? They spend half an hour in that film on that. That's considered
a classic.
That's true.
Yeah. So I refute it on that grounds as well. And I would imagine also that there is an element of the fact that the decision to go from a half-hour show, or as I would say, a 23-minute show to a 45-minute show, it may well be that this script had already been written when it was expected to be a 20-odd-minute show. And therefore, somebody said to the writer, you'll have to put three or four extra scenes in, to extend what you've already got. So I see this with being right at the beginning as perhaps being a transition script. We've had this in Doctor Who where, not so much in terms of the length, but in fact where they found out that the main actor is leading, but the script has been written for an earlier incarnation of the Doctor. So it doesn't always sit. The Doctor's not exactly acting as you would expect him to, because the script was written for the previous incarnation, who had a different way of dealing with things. So I've got a feeling that this particular script may well have been, chopped in half and had another section built in the middle, a little bit like extending an aeroplane or a ship or whatever. And those joints probably do show, and those are what cause people issues with it. That's another thing I would say. Yeah.
You also had the Back to the Future situation where you have, the believability of, like I sing the body electric, the robot in that one, and, or Android, the Android in this one too. What could be used during that time to create something like that? Remember, Back to the Future, the DeLorean had to go on what? TV tubes, just because the transistors weren't around during the 50s. Or, certain things weren't around during that era. So you got the suspension of disbelief suspicion of belief on this episode as well about his creation.
Yeah. And by the way, it has been said it's the first episode. First aired on the 3rd of January 1963. But I agree with Lynn about the fact this girl agreed to go with him after 4 days. I mean, that seems... I mean, even if they said 4 weeks... I think some people would have thought, you know, that would have been a whirlwind romance, never mind the 4 days. Actually, I quite enjoyed it. It was overly long for the body of the script, but I think that that strange scene on the underground did pay off because of that. The scene at the end. Now, what I did think that they could have done better with it is they could have cut out some of that extended work in the middle. What I think they should have done a little bit more is, if you remember, when we have the fight scene between, for want of a better word, the robot and his creator, they leave it where we don't know who's won the fight.
Right, right. And I thought it was well done. I thought that was good.
Right. So we don't know who's knocked on the door at her flat. Now, of course, when she says, "Who is it?" and he starts again with that little game trick that he played. Yeah, right. But the point is, that's to lead you to believe it's the robot again because it's doing the same thing. Now, I think they could have dragged more tension out of the story by having us uncertain as to whether she's going to marry a robot or she's going to
marry a real man, right?
Or a male man, and frankly, wondering which is going to be the worst for her, you know, because of that.
So you're saying they shouldn't have showed the end of what happened. They shouldn't have showed the end result. They should have left it right at where he comes in. She fixes him dinner or snack or whatever, and should have left it there.
And maybe in his image is for her to marry him. Does it matter to her whether he is the robot or the real man? I think they could have made more of the story that way, and they could have increased the tension. They could have played it two ways: either just left it longer for us to know, or as you say, for us to end the story without knowing who it is at the end, because essentially the scene at the underground and the scene in the basement prove that in deeds alone it's the same person.
So
for that reason, I'm not going to give it a high rating, but I would give it 3 out of 5, and I would say if I could put myself back into the time zone and think this was the first of the 1 hour episodes, I wouldn't be blown away about it, but I would be thinking, well, the story has had more time to breathe. I think it could have been tightened up in places and more dramatic content at the end. So it definitely could have been done, but I think that's probably because the script was written as a half hour story, and instead of making it more complex at the end, they basically, as Bobby quite rightly said, they basically stuck an extra 10 minutes in the middle rather than sticking more complexity on at the end, which would have really benefited the story would have really benefited from. So if I'd watched this, I would be thinking, well, it's a reasonable opening story and I'm looking forward to more 1 hour ones. That's what I would have been thinking. So I give it a 3 for down the middle.
Okay, cool. All right. Thank you, Dave. Lou.
Oh, excuse me. It's my turn?
It's your turn, Lou.
Okay. Well, I'm with Dave on this one. I actually thought it was an okay episode. It wasn't a great episode. In terms of structure, I think the first two acts were pretty good. I think the last act where he meets his maker goes on a little long, but I like the sense of mystery that the episode was building up before then.
You mean the fight scene?
Yeah, the whole sequence where he starts talking to him. I mean, you know, his creator's kind of, he's very coy about, you know, who he is and how much he knows. He comes through the open door and he just matter-of-factly accepts him and wonders how much he knows and presumes that he knows a lot. Then he figures out, oh, what do you know? And then he starts, and he just goes into this long conversation. You know, there's a number of times he goes, well, to the point. And, you know, I was like, well, yeah, you should have been to the point from the beginning. But, but you know, that last act goes on a little long. I actually did like it because it does explain a lot of things. I did like the first two acts, or, you know, the introduction of the character and the mystery of who he is. You know, he meets this woman, he knows this woman for a week, she decides to marry him. They go to this town, and all of a sudden his memories, we're not sure why his memories are wrong, because some of it fits, but then some of it doesn't. We wonder if these people ever existed, and, you know, at times we find out that certain characters didn't exist. Then when he goes to the cemetery, we find out that the former chief of police did exist. So there's this kind of uncertainty that is in the story that kind of helps create this mystery of who he is. I mean, part of what he knows is true, but part of what he also knows is false. So, you know, he pieces it together, then he goes and he finds Walter's house in the phone book and he visits him, and then we get the whole, I mean, that's the one problem I have with the story. It's like they deliver all the exposition in the third act.
Right.
It's like,
right.
You get, you know, we not only get the answers, but we get an explanation of why this is what it is. And some of that explanation is really good. I mean, in terms of the robot, I, you know, I was mentioning Blade Runner in the chat room because I think a lot of the description of what the man was trying to create is a little bit like what's in Blade Runner. He gave the robot memories, he gave him a past, and he tried to imprint some of his emotions on him. And then it seemed like he was admitting the one thing he couldn't give the robot was inhibitions, and that's why this robot was able to murder. He didn't have that, you know, he didn't have any inhibitions when it came to, you know, controlling his anger. So I thought that was actually an interesting idea to bring forth about what it means to be human, if anything. Because it's like, you know, our humanity is based on our memories, it's based on our past and how we've developed. But the fact that, you know, if we lack inhibitions, it kind of, and he even says it, he says, you're insane. And to a certain degree, that's like the legal definition of insanity. It's not being able to, define good or evil.
Right.
So, that's what happens with that. But, sorry about the phone. But, you know, I actually enjoyed the episode. I would give it 3 out of 5 stars. The ending was a little long. I wish it was tightened up a little bit more. You know, and admittedly, the reasons why he murders not having inhibition, I mean, I guess being pestered by a religious zealot in the subway is enough to drive anyone crazy just to murder, but...
I think everybody kind of agrees with that. Yeah, she was...
Yeah. But it seemed
she
like
played the role very well. She played the role well.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, there are times where she just went, you know, that flashing light comes in. You know, it's like someone flashes a flashlight in his face, and all of a sudden he starts losing it. And, you know, that was a little, you know, it seemed like she just wasn't completely, you know, it just seemed like he got upset for no reason at all. And I wish they could have maybe just justified that a little more. But, you know, I haven't seen The Twilight Zone as long as you guys have. I'm thinking that when I hear your conversations about how much you didn't like this episode, I think it's probably colored a little bit by what you've seen in the previous 3 seasons and how much this might be cribbing from those.
Oh, this is going till the final episode of this season. So just wait till we get to the end of the season. You think this was bad.
Well, I'm planning to try to visit all the older episodes that I haven't seen along with you guys to see maybe I get more of a sense of where you're coming from. But, you know, like it's like what Dave said, I think it's not a great episode. I think he's right. I think they could have done a little bit more to tighten it and to add a little more tension to the plot. But, you know, for a first stab at a 1-hour episode, I thought it was okay. I mean, I give it 3 out of 5.
Can I ask you, would you agree with me that you think it might well have been an original script for a 1/2-hour story extended rather than written as a 1-hour script? Did you get that sense from it?
Well, maybe from the third act. I thought the third act dragged a little bit. They might have added a little bit here and there. I mean, yeah, he does. You know, visiting the home is one thing. He discovers that it's not his aunt, doesn't even exist. And, you know, he didn't have to go over to the little girl's house, you know, the neighbor's house. I mean, that makes sense, but I guess it wasn't really necessary. I think
a lot of filler.
I think the cemetery scene was kind of necessary. I think it brought up that kind of the sense of mystery where, you know, he says, you know, what happened to the former chief of police? Oh, he died. And they go there and he actually existed. So whereas his aunt never existed, this former chief of police did. And we realize that it's not just his memories that are, you know, because we're all basing what we know on what he says. So he drives in front of this house. Did this house really exist or not? Or is this just his imagination? But then we do see something outside of it that everyone sees is the former chief of police name on the tombstone. So we realize that, no, his memories are in part true, whereas part of it's not true. But yeah, I do think it's possible that they may have added a little bit. I mean, you know, like I said, I only think the third act was the part where it dragged a bit. And as for the idea of not revealing the robot at the end, I'm actually glad that they did in a little way. I mean, it does give kind of an explanation or kind of a moral to the story about how, you know, he learned what it took to be a man to a certain degree. Because the robot was supposed to be everything that he wasn't. He was supposed to be, you know, more of a Don Juan and more confident and more...
Yeah, he was shy. He was very shy.
But it was still
yeah.
in his image. In his. So the point is, the flaws that he had imparted to the robot. You know what I mean?
No, yeah, I do know what you mean. And to a certain degree, yeah. But I think it was also, I mean, he was trying to perfect himself outside of himself with the robot. And I think
the robot what he wasn't.
Yeah. And in some ways, I think the message was, to a small degree, was that he really should have just tried to perfect himself rather than try to do it externally.
Yeah. That's a good moral.
The old saying that we are the sum of our memories, and a lot of movies like The Sixth Day, Dark City, Blade Runner you brought up, Total Recall, where memory is involved in those movies.
Right.
Who are we really? What are we? It brings the whole question, which was part of this episode as well, not just the android itself, but what he thought was believable, and you know, the little overextended whirlwind tour of the city about the building not being on there, or a restaurant not being there, or a person not living there. So
Bicentennial Man, that's just come to
yep.
me. The Robin
yep.
Williams one.
And Lou, you even mentioned Blade. You said something earlier about Blade Runner.
Simplicants
are what they call.
The movie basically was, you know, they were trying to explain why their robots were more real than other robots, and part of the, and the main part was that they had given their robots memories. They had given them a foundation on which they could base their existence on. And I know they explained that here, and that's why it was one of the interesting things, that memories aren't just enough. You have to have, I mean, part of being human is having these inhibitions, and that's what reframes you, that's what keeps you, that's what gives you your moral center.
Right.
It helps you define what's good and evil. Whereas apparently the robot didn't seem to have that, or at least it was always going off at the wrong time or something.
And I watched The Island this week, and The Island was interesting.
Lou, you asked if some of the what were you asking, if some of the episodes were on location or what?
Oh yeah, I was just wondering, because you know, I mean, you mentioned the train station. I mean, some of that looked like it was filmed in an actual train station, not the shots that they took of the people, but...
Yeah, you know, I'm not quite sure.
You've got to be kidding me. They wouldn't give Rob Serling cab fare. You're dreaming.
Okay, well, I didn't know that.
Well,
they don't even dance to get to the studio. Are you kidding yourself?
Okay.
I think when you saw the actual trains, that was filmed.
They just showed small pieces, yeah.
But the platform...
But that could have
been stock footage.
Yeah.
Also, that one episode, Prime Mover, the one with Buddy Ebsen, where you see the car crash, that's taken from Thunder Road. That's footage from the movie Thunder Road.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, most of it is footage. I would say 90% of the episodes are filmed on a set. There are some locations now. What's the one? 100 yards
over the one with the airplane crash, that was stock footage. It was 22, or whatever it's called. The flight, one where the...
That you're thinking of the 22. One...
22.
It's a 22?
Yeah. Where the, it ends with a plane taking off and crashes, yeah.
That was footage.
Yeah.
Yeah. The episode 100 Yards Over the Rim with Cliff Robertson and Rip Van Winkle Caper, they were actually shot on in Death Valley. They were a location, and they were both shot like I think it was a week or 2 weeks apart, and they were both shot in the same location. But very few episodes are shot other than on a set.
And your favorite one, King Nine Will Not Return. That must be done.
Well, Dave, you had an incident in Doctor Who where the underground that they built was so realistic for one of the Second Doctor's episodes that the city was going to sue the producer's production company because they thought it was the actual subway that was filmed. But in reality, it was a set that was built.
Yeah.
It was so realistic.
And yet they've done other things where they took all the cast and crew and took a big double-decker, a London double-decker bus all the way to Dubai to stab the bus, Planet of the Dead, this is, stuck in desert sands. But all it was a vast field. They could have done that at Blackpool almost. You know, it was, I mean, they flew all the way to Dubai, and all they showed of Dubai was a sandy desert.
They actually wanted to sue them. Oh my god, unbelievable! Oh.
Can I say one more thing about the episode, just real
Absolutely.
Quick? I just wanted to remark on the technical aspect of that final act. I thought the split screen technology they did was really well done. I mean,
I thought it was too.
I was looking at scenes
you,
for the.
Yeah, you missed my commentary. That was one of the things that I mentioned. If there was a scene between the split screens, you couldn't see it.
Yeah, I get the feeling that what they might have done was sometimes how they do the split screen is where they have one actor act in front of a rear projection. So so he's acting in front of a screen where he's already been filmed. But I thought the actor did a really good job of, you know, just showing that interplay between the...
Yeah, that was really good. I thought that was great how, you know, you would never have known that they were split screen. It's terrific. There's another episode coming up soon. Death Shift, and you actually can see the scene where they do a double, you know, the two actors are supposed to be, you know, in one shot. Ross Martin is in one shot with himself, and you can see the scene.
Now, just let me ask you on that, Lolan. Can you see that because you're watching it on the DVDs? Because when it went out live on air, that might not have been so visible. If you're watching a DV sort of remastered copy of it, those things can show up and be more evident.
Well, I was watching on a DVD, yeah. So maybe.
So, and what I'm trying to say is, don't forget, I mean, that was one of the problems with Doctor Who, is that we lost about 106 episodes because they reused the tape, because the tape was more expensive than the blooming show. But the point being that when it went out live, some of these things, the definition, obviously, were was it before 625 lines, 500 lines, it was a lower resolution TV screen. So, of course, if it was filmed first and then projected for the live showing, and you're watching a DVD copy of the, you know, the studio footage, as it were, that may be now more apparent. I think that's sometimes you watch shows that were 20 years ago and you think, I don't remember it being that bad. Well, you were watching it through glasses with the,
right,
you know, with Vaseline smeared all over them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's true.
Now we all went to sleep.
Where's this, everybody?
Did everybody give? Well, did you give a rating, by the way, Lynn?
I gave a 2.
Ah, right.
I gave it. Dave, were you? Did you just stop dead talking?
No.
Oh,
I did stop talking.
No, it just sounded like you stopped like dead, and then went silent.
Then everybody went dead.
I am not a robot.
Oh my god. Alright, well, I gave it a 2. Okay, so alright, well, we all gave our ratings. And somewhere, it's not very high, but it's like anywhere from a 0 from Bobby. Right, Bobby? 0?
Yes, right.
Okay, and a 2 from me. And 3 and the 3. And Robert, you gave it a 1, right?
1, yeah. And Julie gave it a 1 also. Yeah.
0, 1, 2, 3. Okay. So, but nothing higher than that. And that's okay. That's cool. So it's not the greatest. But, you know, I didn't think it was horrible. We'll get much worse.
Do you think they should have been given some credit, I mean, for trying the 1-hour format? I mean, don't get going on this stage where you've only, where people watching it live at, in 1963, will have only seen one-hour episode. So, you know, they may well have been thinking, well, you know, they're trying something different.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've never been crazy about the one-hour episodes. I liked it from the beginning at a half an hour. And when it went to the 1 hour, There were a few, a handful that I liked, but not enough to make me say, yeah, this is the way they should have gone. Because it's one thing to flesh something out, and it's one thing to drag it out. And I think they dragged it out for an hour.
Yeah, I think the script needs to be written in a different way. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, fleshing out and dragging out is two different things, you know? I don't know.
Oh, Lynn, do you remember when I was talking with you and Bobby about what they found was the last script that Rod wrote before he passed away?
Oh, yeah.
I got a little information, a little bit more on it and the name of the script that they found. So,
Yeah,
let me go ahead and I'll play. It's only a minute long, so.
Oh.
Covering all the news from every dark corner of the universe. SliceOfSciFi.com.
A long-lost TV teleplay by Rod Serling is on the road to being a potential broadcast because, of course, who else? J.J. Abrams, Bad Robot, has picked up the rights to Serling's The Stops Along the Way, and it will be developed as a TV miniseries.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, really?
No word yet on how or if Abrams will be involved. Odds are, of course, he won't direct any of the miniseries since he's producing two new shows for next year and working on that little Star Wars movie
that
you may have heard
Star
of.
Star Wars thing,
yeah. But that's cool, right? Little lost Rod Serling gem that, you know, Bad Robot does good stuff. So I'm optimistic.
And that's all the information we got so far on that. So let's go ahead and pass it on to everybody there.
Just one last thing. I got something really cool on eBay recently. I bought the 130 episodes, I guess it is. Anyone ever remember or hear of a show called The Zero Hour, hosted by Rod Serling?
The radio show, yeah.
Yeah. Got it on eBay.
Cool.
All 130 episodes on one disc.
On one disc?
On one disc.
Well, they were short radio shows.
They were short.
Yeah.
I bought all 130 on one disc, and I saw it on eBay, and I grabbed it. And it wasn't expensive. $19. No, wait a minute. $14.99. I'm sorry. $14.99 for the disc. 130 episodes. The Zero Hour.
Very soft. This is Rod Serling. We're in a studio in Hollywood preparing to record the first program in a new radio series called The Zero Hour. This new series, especially designed for the new radio, is what you might call a pioneer adventure. We're ready to record the opening.
Ready, Rod? Stand by. Music, stand by. Quiet, please. And here we go.
Yeah. I'm Rod Serling. You're listening to The Zero Hour.
Nine.
Rest your eyes. Exercise your imagination.
Seven.
This week, Bill S. Ballinger's best-selling novel, The Pursuit of a Damned Couple.
Six.
The Wife of the Red-Haired Man.
Five.
Starring Patty Duke-Aston.
Four.
John Astin.
Three.
And Howard Duff.
Two.
In Elliot Lewis's production of...
One.
The Zero Hour.
Fine, very good. Gus, can we get Level on the Rain, please?
Somebody
let
else
know how it turns out.
Well, yeah, there's somebody else selling it, too. I got the one that was... I got it last week, and I know somebody else is also selling it on eBay. So I'd heard of it, but I'd never heard it. I've never heard any of those episodes. I'd only heard of it. So this time I'll get to see what it's like.
Are they radio
promos? Yeah,
Rod did
some promos. Yep.
Yeah, there are promos in there too.
Is this a radio drama or?
It's a radio. Yeah, radio drama.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, all different episodes. Fair fan Ron said $14.99. Bobby must have flipped.
Mm-hmm.
story. You'll hear about it later.
Yeah, he's thrilled. He can't wait to hear it. Oh, man.
Yeah, he had hash browns instead of steak for his tea that night.
There you go. All right, guys. Well, anyway, it's almost 7:30 here, so we're going to get going. Great show, and we'll be back on, I believe it is, the 6th of July, right after the 4th. So I don't know. We might have a low crowd there if people are going away for 4th of July weekend, but if anybody's going to be around on the 6th of July, well, we'd love to have you here, and we are going to be talking about 30 Fathom Grave, starring, who's it starring?
Simon Oakley.
Yeah, thank you. Simon Oakley. Yes, I like him. Simon Oakley. Yeah, and Bill Bixby.
Bill Bixby, yeah.
Yep, Bill Bixby, Simon Oakley. So it's one of those episodes that we're going to be discussing. I don't know if any more than that. Okay, so that's going to be on July 6th, and hope to see you all here. Thanks, Ron. Great to have you here. Great show, yes. And everybody have a great rest of the weekend.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Twilight Zone will continue after station identification.
The ingredients, an American destroyer, the Pacific Ocean, and the ghostly sound of hammering from 30 fathoms below. They add up to a strange tale of the bizarre and nightmarish. Mike Kellen and Simon Oakland star in a very different kind of Twilight Zone, which we call the 30 Fathom Grave.
Ain't that a kick in the head? What do you suppose it is?
Ghosts, man, ghosts.
Here it is, 714. Commissioned December 1941. Sunk in action. First Battle of the Solomons, August 7th, 1942.
Well, that was 20 years ago. Well, Captain Beecham, who's down there? Who's inside that sub?